Ja, wo ist die dabei? And that is when he said that there is no political security without economic self-sufficiency. In other words, that this community, challenged and threatened as it is politically, could not, without independent economic security, safeguard its political security. And as I say, I adopted this mantra because it struck me as absolutely right. And while immodestly claiming a proportionate share of whatever credit might be due, together with all the other social and economic stakeholders and partners in this community that must equally share how Gibraltar has succeeded as a community during the 25 years that I have been a first-hand witness of its progress through my 25 years in this town. I do not wish to bore the House with economic statistics, and I will try to mention none. But in those 25 years, the economy has grown from around a couple of 100 million to the levels the Honourable the Chief Minister announced earlier this week. That is a nearly 6-fold increase in the size of our small economy. Employment has much, much more than doubled. There are many more than twice as many people in economic activity in this community than there were 25 years ago. There has been a huge increase, not just in the number of jobs, but in the quality of jobs and the earnings and take-home pay of our citizens. There has been a huge reduction in the tax burden suffered by our citizens, and there has been a massive real increase in government revenue. All that, in turn, has enabled equally massive forward strides in the services that this community enjoys. The services that people often don't include, or should include, because they are the principal ingredients of the definition of standard of living and quality of life, which is not just measured in the amount of money that you can dispose of as a family to your patients, but also the quality of the health service that you enjoy, the quality of the education that we enjoy as a community, the caring services and the other public services, all of which have seen leap and bound forward strides in the last 25 years. Indeed, I suspect that many of the youngest members of our community simply have no knowledge or understanding of just where Gibraltar came from in respect of what we now take for granted in the general description of social well-being. There have been massive and forward strides in housing availability, both public and private, in, as I say, disposable income. In the renewal, we have been able to renew our major public amenities and institutions, our prison, our hospitals, our air terminal, our courthouses, our sports, our medical facilities, public housing. We have been able to engage in transformational urban renewal and beautification. So there is no doubt that in the last 25 years, and I will say a little bit more, I keep on saying 25 years because that is what my purpose happened, political literacy, but it is not this community, and I will recognize in this moment the indispensable contribution made by those who came before us in achieving whatever it is that this community has been able to achieve. So, a huge improvement in the quality of life and standard of living of all Gibraltarians. But more importantly, or perhaps most importantly beyond that, it has delivered economic security, and with it, the greater political security that was the other half of the mantra that I mentioned. In short, this community has proved adept at caring for the infamous metaphoric political party. And we've known how to not just ensure that the pear does not fall metaphorically from the tree, but that the pear has grown and that we have been able to benefit from it. and that is a measure, not just for the correctness of the mantra, but the skill and success with which successive generations of political leadership in the world has been able to put the mantra in effect, into effect. So gone are the days on the back of our political security, of our economic security. Gone are the days of our political forefathers having to go cup in hand with requests for development aid to the UK with political conditions attached. And for the, not for the first time, I will recognize in this fact just how much harder it was for, if I could just call it loosely, pre-1988 government leaders, thought of money as they always were, to govern the world and to advance the social and economic prospects of this community with a much smaller, much less prosperous economy and therefore much more constrained availability of funding for the government. Their job in seeking to grow the political system, as well as economic system, was therefore all the more difficult, and we owe a debt of gratitude to those who laid the ground that we were then able to cultivate and grow the rich economic, social, and political harvest that we to harvest from the ground that they were in. So gone are the days when we are making sat on our most valuable land resources. So too gone are the days of bilateralism between the UK and Spain. Now we have instead the double lock, when the UK will not only not give away our sovereignty without our wishes, the famous preamble to the Constitution, but will not even negotiate or discuss our sovereignty without our freely expressed consent. And although I recognize that it was my predecessor in office, David Summit, who effectively broke psychologically the mold of not subservient, because I don't think any of his predecessors were subservient, but the previous mold of political and government relationships with the world and the UK, it was the new constitution of 2006 that definitively reduced to print the degree of self-government and autonomy that this community had, in a sense, helped to serve to the bold political actions and courage before the electorate in making good the equally democratic and necessary mantra that Gibraltar is best governed by Gibraltarians for Gibraltarians. And so the new constitution, and so the double lock, and so the end to bilateralism, and so the fact that nobody nowadays seriously contemplates the realistic prospect that it is possible, not just undesirable, that it is not even possible for the UK and Spain to contemplate passing a deal and accepting a peace status and a peace arrangement behind the back and over the heads of the people of the world. That degree of political security, which has been won gradually over 25 and more years, is itself the result of our growing economic independence and the economic security that comes with it. And therefore, I do not think that the correctness of the mantra economic security is necessary, not just because it is desirable to give the people of Gibraltar a good standard of living, but also because it is the necessary ingredient for our political security. I don't think, on the basis of the evidence of the last 25 and more years, I don't think that anybody can possibly doubt that that is the correct and successful mantra that would underpin the conduct of politics and government in the world. So I could now stop looking backwards and turn my strong sonic gaze forward a little. given what I have just said about the correctness of the Bible, it would be, it's my view, that this community cannot take for granted. We cannot assume that economically good times will always be with us. We have had a very long and good run of good economic times. And there is a danger that we all get, you know, rather like a generation that has never seen a front and pocket stuff. You know, we can all get lulled into a sense of self-security, that economic hard times can never hit Gibraltar, that we've got the magic formula that whatever happens anywhere else, you know, things will always be rosy in our gardens and nothing will ever appear on the horizon to challenge our standard of living and to challenge everything that we enjoy today. Well, as many countries have discovered in the last 5 or 6 years, this is simply not true, and it is simply not a safe assumption upon which to ensure the, that our future generations of libertarians enjoy the good fortune that we, this generation of libertarians, are undoubtedly enjoying. And I'm not talking about mistakes that any Gibraltar government might make, and of course all Gibraltar governments will make mistakes. That's not what I'm saying. I'm referring to local factors out of the government's control, global and regional factors out of the government's control, and the banks out of the government's control, any of them could at any time deliver a change of prospect compared to the good one that we enjoy today. And now that I hope that after sort of 25 years of the modernization, of the rebuilding, of the repositioning of Gibraltar, now that I hope that as a political class, we, or more likely you, because I will not be part of it for very much longer, can agree that perhaps that rebuilding and that renewal of Gibraltar is substantially complete. There are things still left to be done, but there is a limit even to the amount of houses, for example, which is historically our acute problem. There is a limit to even the amount of housing, home ownership housing, that this community has given its limited size to absorb. There are, I acknowledge, pending things left to do. There is the urban resource treatment plant, there is power generation and distribution, there is a boat in the tunnel still to do, and there are things to do at the major time. And it will always be the wish of Gibraltar government to invest part of the fruit of our economic success in further improvement of the modernization of Gibraltar and its community, and the personal prospects for individual economies of families within our society. But I think it must be fully true that we must now be much closer to the end of that journey than even to the middle of it, let alone to the beginning of it. And that said, we need to consider, we need to have a I don't know how you can happen with great difficulty in the sector of modern politics. But this community needs for its own good, in my modest opinion, to find a way where it can, over a period of time, somehow rebuild or recalibrate or refocus our approach to the business of government, the business of politics, away from really what we've had for the last 20 or more years, where, you know, we compete with each other to see who offers more, who offers better, to spend more, to cut taxes more, to do this more, to do that more, because this is the perfect wretched. This will end in tears if it is not at some point interrupted collectively. Of course, I am not pointing the finger at this government or at this opposition, because we have all engaged in it. We have all engaged in it. I am not saying that this is a lesson or for anybody in particular. I'm speaking of how, what I would like to see if I look forward. 5, 10 years from now, what would have changed for the good of that economic security, which we all agree is important for our political security, might have happened. And we need to find, and I do not underestimate, for the reason of a 570 comments and consequent figures, precisely for those reasons, I do not underestimate the difficulty of finding it. But I think it will be a clear legacy that the new generation of political leadership in Gibraltar will leave, perhaps more valuable and more lasting than anything tangible that they achieve, if they are able to work together to deliver that change in the way in which we conduct politics, that recalibration, and that rebasing. So, going around full circle to the very beginning of my address, and my reference to the great class of ideas, Jogasana's Rainy Day Fund versus Gahuana's spend and spend to grow approach. Has the time now come? Has the day now come? Has the moment now come to focus more on the Rainy Day Fund attitude? My view. I'm not saying this is what 10 years could have done overnight. I mean, I would be shocked and slightly disappointed at the next general election. A sort of base manifesto promised to do absolutely nothing that costs anybody. I'm likely to surprise you. So, this is a process that has got to take place. And in the process, it's not any new chance of success has to start with a conversation about what, how the process should be carried out. And perhaps some external, non-political, but local intervention or assistance might assist. So, should we be putting money aside in a sort of sovereign wealth fund or reserve to cushion us from such bad times or less good times as may become Gibraltar in the future, so that we can protect, guarantee our economic security, and through it, protect and guarantee our political security? I think the answer is yes. And if I should ever succumb to the temptation, which is obviously presently no evidence whatsoever, that of writing some sort of book, and I ever answer the self-same question of what sort of things do you regret not having done or not having done better during the 15 years that I had the stewardship of this community, somewhere in that list there would be that I didn't start creating sovereign wealth fund I'm not talking about that scale. I'm talking about putting to one side a significant proportion of our surpluses and our wealth and investing in assets so that over a period of time we are not baffled the government and its revenues and the economy at large. So, as I say, this would almost certainly require this sort of change of shift. I would dearly like and hope to see it materialize at some point in my lifetime. And as we sort of move on in this sort of rather self-indulgent or indulgent review. And what else would Gibraltar benefit from advancing in now that we have made the economic, social, and the political progress that the hard work of successive generations and successive political parties and successive governments and successive economic stakeholders and social stakeholders have already achieved? We need, I think, to move on to the next agenda of change and modernization. So when, I'm not saying that it may not be now, but when we all agree that, you know, we finish remodernizing and rebuilding and refurbishing and beautifying and providing parks and yacht marinas and housing and new courthouses and new airports, when we finish all that, what is the next level that will take the Gibraltar, that next qualitative step in our collective journey towards a prosperous, modern, European member of a family of nations that fall into that as you say. There are one or two things that I'm going to touch on. Well, you know, it's not that long ago that this place was an assembly. And you know, in the new constitution, we managed to get it recognized as a parliament. And there is a difference between a parliament and an assembly. An assembly simply theoretically exists for the purposes of passing laws, where the parliament has got a much wider role in the governance of the affairs of a country beyond the simple role of passing laws. And whilst recognizing the improvement introduced by the honourable members of the way that this house works since they arrived in office, I don't think that can be the end of that agenda in terms of the wider, deeper, new agenda of further modernization, not just of the way the Parliament works, but of the quality of democracy in Gibraltar. By which I mean, how do we make the way democracy works in Gibraltar more like the way democracy works in larger, more modern, developed European countries, and less like what we have been all these years? An assembly snatching for powers from the administering power, if I can call that, fighting for self-government powers, and not focusing on the things that other countries have been focusing on, because it was premature for us to do so, because the focus was on just acquiring the right to govern ourselves without focusing on how we govern ourselves when we got to power. Just as it, I think, or is instantly perhaps the focus of the agenda for the future. And I think high on that list, how can we that a discussion, a consideration by those who will do the brainstorming, that is the next generation of political leaders in the world, sitting on both sides of this house, but not including me, an independent and balanced mechanism. And in talking about an independent and balanced mechanism, I'm not treading on the debate about whether if things had been done to the company, had been done to the government, where public debt would then be too high or too low. I'm not talking about quantum. I'm talking about the machinery of transparency, whether you're in government, or whether he's in government, or whoever's in government in 30 years' time. Because, you see, transparency cannot depend. We tend to debate transparency as it affects us across the floor of this house. But most European countries have moved on, as honourable members have been part recognised by freedom of information legislation. Transparency nowadays is not just between politicians. Citizens are entitled to be the beneficiaries of transparency as well. And they don't have the right to come into this house to ask a street, or less street, or more street, or better informed, or less well informed questions. So transparency cannot depend on asking parliamentary questions, or on deciphering, or making deductions from the answers, or even understanding the answers. Transparency has got to be, if we want to look like other countries, it's got to be systemic, and it's got to be automatic. And the information is just got to be there. For those who understand it, to see it. For those who don't understand sometimes it's tough to abuse it, but at least there, visible, without the need to, without the need to sit and frown and ask, beg and debate and do all manner of things in order to try to get to it. And remember, Mr. Speaker, and I am describing the position as I would like to be in the future. As you know, we have governed under the system, such as it is, as well. Of course, we have a different view, as the honourable members know, in the context of the current debate. We have a different view about the extent to which that system is being used now compared to the sort of thing that we did, but that is not the debate that I'm addressing at this time. But I can. Every time the Honourable Chief Minister accuses the Leader of the Opposition as well of not understanding what he has been told, that the information is there, in a sense, and this may be an active test of the correctness or not of what I am saying, in a sense, every time you get the opportunity to say that to a political opponent, there is an element of recognition that the necessary degree of automatic availability of the information is absent. Because in saying, you have to ask the right question. You haven't read it. There is an admission there that you have to ask the question, for example. But you have to do it. That you have to make it happen, as opposed to fiscal matters. Mm-hmm. And by fiscal matters, I have to say, Mr. Speaker, that I understand. I do not claim any particular authority for this issue. But in my personal opinion, transparency of public finances should and must include the handling by the government of all money that is handled, whether it be in government-owned companies, as it to be, as well, or whether it be in the thing that we are technically debating at this time, which is the Consolidated Fund and the Improvement and Development Fund. In other words, any economic interest about which those that are elected into the political office have dispositive power over should be the subject of whatever modern automatic transparency mechanism is in place. And that is, I don't think, the case for them. This gives the opportunity that I do not wish to miss in this, my last address to this house, to afford my friend, the Leader of the Opposition, Daniel Eaton, for the brave, honest, and consistent way in which he has done the opposition's difficult job of addressing these complex questions that do not always strike a chord with citizens as they go about their day-to-day work. But who in this house can honestly say that they would not be, that they would have been surprised if a Leader of the Opposition doing his job as we in a non-partisan sense would expect a Leader of the Opposition to do, if the Leader of the Opposition had not addressed this debate in the name of country. And then people can have different views, people can agree or disagree. I think the House well knows the view that you take on this kind of debate of that debate. I think that Danny is a worthy and able and hard-working successor of mine in the leadership of the party, and I sincerely hope that all those people who are otherwise minded to vote for the GSP at the forthcoming general election will place their trust in him if he can get to it. The question also when we're looking at the list of possible new architecture for the future, we might also have, for example, an independent budget responsibility mechanism, as we now have in the United Kingdom, where perhaps, and this is something that I considered in my time and decided against, but it's something worth considering from time to time, whether an international credit rating, which necessarily imposes the degree of external the market question is a but it has its democratic advantages So, as we can see that the next generation of leaders will have to be based in sin and take the world forward in ways and whatever other elements they think could be included in the world with new agenda items for the future, as their predecessors have done in relation to the economic and political security of the world. My view, the goal should be, what does this community need to do in terms of its system of government to bring Gibraltar closer to the way other European democracies do democracy? I don't mean that we vote for a government, and I don't mean all the improvements that they have introduced over the last 4 years in the frequency of meetings. I don't underestimate or mischaracterize the value of the improvement, and I recognize them as improvements, but I think it's taken the agenda as much further forward. Mr. Speaker, I cannot end without making a brief reference to external affairs. To reduce the proposition to the research and simple, in my view, and having sat in the chair there for 6.5 years and been told and pushed and considered this and looked at that and considered the other and put everything into the decision making process at different times. After 15.5 year learning curve, effectively, I am firmly of the view that if there is to be any architecture, which I thoroughly recommend that there should be, for ongoing dialogue between involving both Gibraltar and Spain, the bilateral or some version of it, which respects the essential ingredients of the bilateral process, is the only way forward. I don't say that the precise architecture of what we call the bilateral process is the only viable method, but any method that replaces it, if one is to replace it, has got to respect the essential ingredients of that language, because that is where our political security lies. And of course, and this is a favorite general question to another, still the final answer, there can and must never be a return to bilateralism process, because that necessarily amounts to a denial of our rights as a people, and the moment that we sign up to a denial of our rights as a people, then as sure as my colleagues say, there will be a disrespect of those rights by others. And in respect of the cause of that agreement, it can be differentiated from the bilateral process. The cause of the agreement is simply the first supposed fruit of the trilateral process. Insofar as the Cordoba Agreement is concerned, we have, at not inconsiderable cost to us as a small community, honored our side of the bargain, and Spain must do the same. And the consequences of Spain not doing the same are not just that the fruits of the Cordoba Agreement are denied to the people on both sides, such as the fruits were for one side or the other of the vote. It is the fact, and this is in a sense the most worrying aspect of it, that if Spain does not honor the Cordoba Agreement, then I do not see how any Gibraltar government in the future can be asked or expected to, or can safely itself decide such agreement of a political kind with Spain in the future. And the EU must itself take care that it does not aid and debate about Spain's environment and compliance with the EU agreement, with the Cordoba agreement, such that if the EU is not itself contributing to making the political relationship between the three parties in relation to Gibraltar more complex. I am, of course, referring to the Cordoba Airport Agreement, which, by the way, was notified to the EU, was notified to all the member states. And not only does Spain have a moral, political, it is not a legal, but it is a treaty obligation to honor that. But if you, who accepted notification of the arrangement, and accepted changes of language in EU aviation measures in consequence of those changes notified by the UK and by Spain, cannot adopt a position of neutrality. Neutrality means that you adopt a position that does not favor or oppose one side or another to an extreme. Neutrality neither requires nor justifies that you aid in the best somebody in resigning from an agreement which they have made with one of the sides who has implemented and which has been noticed. The word neutrality in that respect is much abused, in my view, by European community statesmen. So I applaud the Honourable Member's office of insistence in holding the UK to those agreements, and frankly, it would be, in my opinion, a shocking betrayal by the United Kingdom of Gibraltar if they ever struck any form of compromise agreement in relation to the airport non-implementation that had the effect of excluding, suspending, or making in any other state, manner, or form exceptional Gibraltar's right to, in theory and in practice, immediately benefit from all EU aviation measures to have secured the agreement for integrity. And so, the Honourable Members will have the support of this side of the House for the remainder of this Parliament, as I'm sure whoever forms the next UK government will have it from them in the next Parliament. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank honourable members on both sides of the House for over so many years their friendship, their honesty, and their respect, even in political adversity. There have been many tough, bitter, aggressive, and angry moments. Of course, none of them contributed to that. That consistency with, I think, our Gibraltarian instinct, I believe we never ever forgot that it was only politics, and that we never intended personal harm or hurt or offense to anybody, even though it would not surprise me if it had happened in the court. I, for myself, am proud to say that, insofar as concerns me, that statement is true. I thank also my friend, the leader of the opposition, Dan Keaton, and the Honourable Albert Heatherer, for their very kind, warm, and generous words about me during their intervention yesterday. And, sorry, yes. Yes, of course. Mr. Speaker, that may be a convenient moment because I understand he is not going to be here tomorrow when I reply, for me to say something which I intended to say in the course of my reply tomorrow, but I wish him to be in the House to hear it. Given that he suddenly came to speak for 10 minutes and has gone on for 40, there would be much more that I need to reply to that we might not want to be around to hear, but if I could just pause our disagreement for a moment and reflect with him here in the House on his 25 years of service to the community, which I think is absolutely right to mark, and I thank him for giving way and for allowing me to do that. If I was to go and start at 11 o'clock, I was quite worried. This is the budget debate. Peter can run over his feet. I had 6 and he had 7. And it all started to feel quite like when I was first elected in 2003. I'm very pleased that my life has now done that, and if it comes to a vote of confidence, I stand a better chance of winning it than I did when I first saw him across the floor of the House. Formidable as he then was, as leader of this House in November 2003. Mr. Speaker, he became a Queen's Counsel in 1998, 2 years after becoming Chief Minister, an honour which it was right to bestow on him because of the work he had done before he became Chief Minister, as a vouchsafing and recognition of his skills as an advocate, which he then deployed for 16 years on behalf of one client in particular, Gibraltar PLC. And we have had many disagreements at the time that he has been in politics, not just between him and me, but of course between the party that he represented and the party I now represent, because it is in the nature of our adversarial system of politics that we highlight the things on which we disagree. And if on every day we disagree about one thing and agree on 99 others, nobody looks at those 99 others. It is in the nature of our system that we apply the magnifying glass to that one area of disagreement. And of course, there are many things on which we agree, and we are only in this place usually concentrating on things that we disagree. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, having become Chief Minister, when I was notified that he was going to be invested as Chief CMG, I was very happy and proud for all of the people of Gibraltar that Her Majesty was going to recognize the service of the Gibraltarian community in that way, especially given the fact that 16 years in the job that he was doing, and I have done only for three, requires a level of dedication and commitment of time and of being able to withstand the pressures of others, which put in our community principally expressed on the question sitting in the chair and now sit, but that was in fact a very worthy recognition indeed of the work that he has done. Mr. Speaker, I always worry when Peter Cohen is on his feet in this place, and I am nodding to what he is saying. And there were instances during the course of what he was saying when I found myself nodding. Happily, I found myself shaking my head and whispering to the Deputy Chief Minister about the glory of the man to say something. But I think he would be delighted to hear that. Because I think, like Joe Bassano, like Margaret Thatcher, if you spend, you know, 20 years in frontline politics and you don't divide opinion, you've not really achieved anything at all. I think Margaret Thatcher would have been delighted to see that there were strikes on the day of her funeral, and that the people would be delighted to hear that the Deputy Chief Minister and I thought that we couldn't believe how he was thinking he was getting away with some of the things he was saying this morning. I want to thank him, Mr. Speaker, for recognizing those sort of contributions of Joe Bassano in the way that he generously has today. The time will come when we have to pay tribute to Joe Bassano, but not today, but it was right that in his last intervention during the course of this appropriation debate, he has wanted to do so. And he has done some generous things, and I'm grateful for that on behalf of members on this side of the House. Mr. Speaker, Peter Ivana is everything but an easy adversary. He is probably the toughest adversary I will ever face. And therefore, he was a good trainer for somebody who's got to go up against adversaries internationally, against the Gibraltar. And defeating him on the 9th of December 2011, and therefore, I put him a massive personal achievement for all of us in this house and in this side of the house, and I say that to laud him and to compliment him in saying it, because he was a giant as Chief Minister, and difficult to see how we might debunk him. Mr. Speaker, in the 16 years that we've been here, I'm not going to hide the fact that we have huge disagreements. Certainly the time I was here and the time that Joe Bassano was leading this party before them. But as I said in the morning of the election, in the 16 years that he was here, he didn't do everything wrong. He did much which was right and which we recognized, but of course our system, as I said, did not allow us to concentrate on those issues. I don't think he's the greatest libertarian of all time or the greatest libertarian of our time. And I don't think he thinks that either, Mr. Speaker, and wouldn't be embarrassed in somebody pretending to claim that for him. But his remarkable election record, Mr. Speaker, demonstrates the regard in which this community held him for a very long time. I must say, I have absolutely no desire to emulate his record in that respect, but the respect of the people of Gibraltar in political terms was expressed at election time with votes in numbers and who they put on this side of the House, and they have demonstrated their regard for him in that way. And as politicians, I know he and I understand, as do all the rest of us sitting in this House, that that is the greatest compliment that the community could have paid him. But the thing I want to take with you to the others who are not in this house this morning, and that is to his family, because all of us in this house, and those who have sat in the chair in which I now sit in particular, the sacrifice, the time that one has to give up, and that one's family has to give up, and the sacrifice and intrusion that one's family has to put up with because one is in politics. They have had him back now for some time, and they have even more time from him now that he is not going to offer himself for the election. His family has grown. He is now a grandfather, and I'm sure that those pursuits will be much more enjoyable even than putting a wretched young barrister against the ropes in this place as he used to roll through all those years ago. These days, Mr. Speaker, he is generous in his advice and generous with his time whenever a current chief minister has to request that a previous chief minister recall why certain things happened in a particular way or why certain letters were written in a particular way. And he is always available on the end of the phone when I need to speak to him. I am extremely grateful on behalf of the government and on behalf of the whole of the industry that he is available for that purpose. All of us, Mr. Speaker, in each of our ministerial posts, build on the work of those who have come before us. And in the same way as the first handover of power in 1973 from the AACR to the IWBC and then again to the AACR, and then to the GSOP and then to the GOP and back, all of us are building on the work that each of us has done, and I am building on 16 years of work done by him, and I want to thank him as part of all the community for that. He has been very clear previously, having relinquished the post of leader of the opposition, that his interest, that the interest of most Gibraltarians, if not all Gibraltarians, is simply to see Gibraltar continue to succeed, and that is exactly what we are embarked upon. He has expressed that in a way I think people see as genuine. He has avoided the cut and thrust of the partisan fray since he left the post and went to the backbenchers. He's introduced the concept of a backbencher, something that he used to be against when he was in government, but there he is on the backbenchers speaking in a non-partisan way. And I hope that he has had enough of the partisan fray. Quite unlike others, Mr. Speaker, I wish him all the best in any endeavor he may decide to pursue, even politics, as long as it's not on the other side of me. But I can think of two people who might better represent different in international organizations than Sir Peter Cahill, who is some international organization that would decide that they would benefit from his representation, and he would, of course, enjoy the support of the government in every respect in that way. Mr. Speaker, his political career is not over yet. It's a very good election debate, and there's still some time to go before political before an election. But I don't want to write him off. But given that he has written himself off, if I may just end by saying that, you know, giants are people who can crush you and people you might disagree with, but they're still very big, and he is a giant who can do the same. Well, Mr. Speaker, I think that is an extraordinarily generous set of remarks, and I am extraordinarily grateful to the Honourable Member for his spirit in objectively and fairly recognising what he may think and what he has achieved in the past. And I think it demonstrates that inbuilt somewhere into the DNA of our adversarial political system is the ability of people to differentiate between politics, political instability, and personal instability. And then when it comes to charge, I think a human being is more and more, which is the key is more important. I have to say, Mr. Speaker, when I relegated myself to the back bench, I hadn't fully understood that I would be then thereafter liberally referred to as the backbencher in official parliamentary debate. But nevertheless. Mr. Speaker, I am in conclusion, I am not a person given to an extent of demonstration of emotion, but I have being hugely privileged and honoured by the people of Gibraltar and by my party and by my parliamentary colleagues to serve as their leader for many years. And I wish to thank them, the colleagues in the party, the colleagues in government, and above all the people of Gibraltar that entrusted me with their most valuable thing, their future and the future of their children for so many years. Of course, I have not succeeded in everything that I have tried, and there are many things that I have done which, no doubt, I could have done better. I would be satisfied with the judgment that, on balance, I gave it my best and I left nothing in the inquiry, so to speak, of my own effort in trying as best as I saw it to advance the interests of this community. Nor had I calculated that there was a huge amount of time left for the next general election, so I will enjoy whilst it lasts, and we must be down to months by now. And I expect, my lord, that I shall miss this place more, judging by even the generous comments of my learned friends, some of the members of it will miss me. But still, that is life. I wish all future governments, or whatever that is, of colour, Godspeed and every possible success in their continuing story of this fantastic country, of this fantastic people, and fantastic and worthy people through our collective journey. And as we sometimes forget, against odds that are stacked up against us by a much larger and much more powerful country and organisation, I will always be available to assist all Gibraltar governments in any way that I can in pursuit of those interests of this great community that gives us all such a happy, high standard of living and quality of life to enjoy with our families. Thank you all very much.
Of the House. When the Honourable Sir Peter Capuana first sat in the House, he was occupying the seat that the Honourable Edmund Reilly was occupying, and I was occupying the seat that the Honourable Dan Speaker was occupying. We were sitting fairly close, and we are still sitting fairly close, in different capacities. Is it the end of the world? Well, strange things happen in politics and public life. Only time will tell. The Honourable Samantha Secretary.
Mr. Speaker, quite amazing how time flies, and this has been my first Parliament. And this will be my last budget address of this Parliament, making it important to pause for a moment and reflect on all that has been achieved for our community by this government in our first term in office. Of all the departments that I am responsible for, nowhere is the trend as apparent or as rewarding, in my view, as the tremendous progress that has been made in social services in such a short period of time. We have gone, Mr. Speaker, from a haphazard disjointed service that, by the very nature of its disorganisation, failed to support and reach out to people as it should, to one that is now a far cry from this. The priority has been to reorganise and restructure in a way that has best worked for the service, and the service continues a process of self-assessment and review as needs and priorities change. To say that in the history of social services, it is the first time ever that there is a full complement of staff is an achievement in itself. But this government has not stopped there, and we have invested in increasing the number of social workers and support staff. following restructures, investment in staff, resources, and tools, means that social workers are now able to discharge their professional duties and are no longer put in a position where they have to work with their hands tied behind their backs and can now go further and have the capacity to develop strategic policies. Historically, Mr. Speaker, one of the problems was in the recruitment of social workers. Because traditionally, this is not a profession that has been very popular locally. We have tackled this head on, and in the short term, we have teamed up with specialised recruitment agency in the UK to ensure that the recruitment process is quick and effective, and we have a steady supply of social workers in the short term. And working with the Department of Education, we are engaging with the comprehensive schools and the college to raise awareness in training of this in this as a profession. In order to properly support social work graduates, once they return, so that they are properly trained and with the right amount of support and experience, 2 years ago we introduced 4 additional posts for newly qualified social workers, where they undertake rotations throughout the service, benefiting from the experience of their colleagues. Since the reception, Mr. Speaker, the care agency exclusively deals with social services and no longer elderly residential services. This is the final piece in the jigsaw, Mr. Speaker, to enable the organisation to fully focus on social services for the community and work more cohesively at senior management level, and I will deal with the individual teams in turn. The exemplary team at social services provides a better service year on year, Mr. Speaker. It's important to note, to say, Mr. Speaker, that during this term of office, we have increased the complement of social workers by 4, introduced 4 new posts for newly qualified social work graduates, 2 social worker assistants, and more administrative support. With this investment, we have been able to take social services to a whole new level. The Children and Family Services, Mr. Speaker, is made up of different services providing children and their families in need. Early intervention is essential so as to ensure that children do not need placement outside their family home. And Mr. Speaker, we are now, I'm delighted to report at a stage where we can provide them. Although safeguarding and child protection is what usually gets into the public arena, it is the work that is invested in the early stages that ensures that families move on from crises and resolve their difficulties. So investment into early intervention work, Mr. Speaker, is the right thing to do, and it is what we are now doing, because it helps avoid family breakdown, criminality, domestic abuse, and substance misuse, among other issues. As part of the structure of social services, Mr. Speaker, we have introduced a duty team to deal with the initial referrals of the service, and they have now been able to develop databases in the last 3 years to gather information on the referrals that they received. This will assist in highlighting trends in society and, as a consequence, identify where the needs lie. In fact, Mr. Speaker, as an anecdote, I've this morning received an email from the head of the service informing me of a complimentary remark from another government department on how well the duty team is working and how we're very actively and proactively follow up on referrals. And it's another example of how and why the service works well and we work at a multidisciplinary and multi-agency level in a cohesive way, Mr. Speaker. Something that was never done before. We are now at a stage where we've developed a database for domestic abuse. And this serves to highlight families where it's a common occurrence and intervention is required. It also helps us identify families where the difficulty has begun to arise and support is offered to the couples can resolve their issues without this impacting on their children. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, recently 2 social workers and the agency psychologist attended a training program in UK to deal with victims and perpetrators of domestic abuse. The work carried out in this program is usually incorporated in a child protection plan. Because it is no longer good enough to safeguard and protect victims and their children, and we recognise that perpetrators continue to act out in the behaviour that they have learned, and punishment itself is not the only solution. These perpetrators will continue to act out their behaviour and they continue to be parents, so they must be assisted in making the necessary changes and break the cycle. Mr. Speaker, the long-term team will deal with child protection, adoption and fostering, support welfare, children with disabilities and children in need. I'm delighted to report that thanks to the investment in increasing the number of staff, the court welfare, social workers in the court welfare team no longer have a delay in preparing court reports, a problem that was endemic for many years before we took office. We have introduced a website service for children with disabilities, and this fulfills one of our manifesto commitments. The Status of Child Protection Committee continues to meet and it ensures that safeguarding training is offered to all who work with children. And the most significant development in child protection is the commissioning of a comprehensive child protection policy for Gibraltar, which will truly be a landmark document and policy. This has been a 2-year project led by Social Services that involves all government departments and key stakeholders and is now in the final stages. The purpose of the adult services in social services is to assist vulnerable people aged 18 or older and to live as independently as possible in the community. They have 8 separate areas of responsibility, which include, in addition to general social work, ancillary care, safeguarding adults, daycare services for people over 50, out-of-hours emergency social work, overseas placement for adults with learning disabilities, and the convening stage for look after children who need care, and they also sit on the multi-agency public protection and work of managing sex offenders. We've had significant achievements this year. Our one point of contact referral system is now firmly in place and is being used by different professionals working to ensure social work services for a range of potential users. And there are clear pathways to the system in place to ensure fair and transparent access to the different services. The Gibraltar Multi-Agency Safeguarding Adults at Risk Abuse Procedures, and I am the chairman of that committee, Mr. Speaker, has been very successful, with the number of referrals being received from other professionals continuing to increase over the past year. This is due to the increase in awareness around safeguarding as a result of a rolling program of anti-agency training in basic awareness, and 174 people have undertaken this training this year. The housing department is now also represented on that committee, Mr. Speaker. A Gibraltar public protection panel has been set down to ensure effective communication and a joint approach to monitoring of people who could pose a threat to the general public, Mr. Speaker. The head of the service has been assigned the role of safeguarding officer, and the senior social worker is the data controller for the agency under those procedures. The number of people coming under these procedures, Mr. Speaker, has more than doubled in the past year. In addition, Mr. Speaker, the team sits in the multi-agency domestic violence working group, which are established and is drafting procedures within the different professional areas, but they work effectively in partnership to reduce the risk of domestic violence and work with survivors and their families. But of all the achievements, Mr. Speaker, I think that there are 3 main achievements during this term that are so significant that while they haven't taken place during this financial year, I think they are important and I need to mention them. So the first of all is the establishment of a brand new purpose-built day centre for the elderly at Waterport Terrace. This consolidates the service that used to be provided at different locations, and this means that now not only can people move to the more pleasant and comfortable surroundings, which are completely accessible, and by having large premises, we can open up the service to more people. Then, Mr. Speaker, there has been the establishment of a focus on dementia. And social services is a key player in that alongside colleagues at the GHO. And a multi-agency dementia working party was convened by the government, by this government, Mr. Speaker, to draft a dementia strategy for Gibraltar and support dementia services. Finally, Mr. Speaker, and one of the things that I can be most proud of is this government's unprecedented investment in domiciliary care, which has seen the biggest injection of recurrent expenditure in the area. The GST budget for this service, when they were in office, was £600,000. Now, have increased it to 2.5 million. So imagine how many more people have received home help. And this doesn't only help them, speaker, but their families also benefit from this service. Mr. Speaker, it's an important way of caring for our community, and it helps more of our elderly citizens remain safely and independently at home. And to make sure that this service runs effectively and efficiently, we are constantly reviewing the administration of it. We recently invested in a new database system to control the domiciliary care service sector. A senior social worker is dedicated to overseeing the service, and the team regularly attend ward and bed management meetings at hospitals as well when this is necessary. Turning to disability services, Mr. Speaker, and before I start, I wanted to say that the doctor without the inquiry is necessary. The inquiry says that there is abuse, but we need to move on from that and resume. Mr. Speaker, the service comprises of St. Bernadette's Day Centre for Adults with Learning Disabilities, Dr. Hiraldi Home, and the service in the community. The service today, Mr. Speaker, is nothing like the service from a few years ago, and it has come on in leaps and bounds. I make it a point to visit the services regularly and meet with the service users and their families, and I am incredibly proud of all that we have achieved. The unprecedented strategic approach in the recruitment of staff and the intense training, both internal and external, has clearly made all the difference. The way that we work at the services is different, Mr. Speaker. There are now structured and meaningful activities. Many of these take place in the community. There is clear support plan for the individuals in order that we can maximize the benefit to service users. There are so many innovations that we have done in the service, Mr. Speaker, that I would probably be here for about 3 hours just speaking on the differences that we have made there, Mr. Speaker. But I concentrate on the main point. Importantly, we have extended the service, Mr. Speaker, particularly in relation to respite at Dr. Hiraldi, to meet the growing needs in the community. There have been further refurbishment of the premises as well as investment in the equipment. We continue to work on raising awareness of people with learning disabilities all the time. And our service is about making people matter and to give them an opportunity to showcase their abilities. The design of the devolved assistance stamp by service users at the St. Bernadette Centre is a prime example of this. Training throughout the agency, Mr. Speaker, has completely changed. And that is alluded to by Mr. Meza yesterday, where he tried to convince people that we were using the same program that they did when he was an office speaker. In answer to Parliament questions, I told him that I wouldn't give him the program because it was an internal government document and that it was not appropriate for him to attempt to micromanage his service, for which he is no longer the minister. He had plenty of opportunities to do that when it was his responsibility. We do things our way, and clearly the results show that it is better way, Mr. Speaker, because the training we delivered is dedicated, it's need-led, and it's more focused than any other school. And given that the agency is now smaller, it's easier to deliver the training, the focused training. But it must be recognized that the training team has provided intense training, not only to numerous care workers and recruits in-house, but when we were responsible for elderly residential services, to a lot of the people who are now based in Montalvania and elsewhere. And they have also teamed up with ETCL and have been running courses on elderly care for ETCL at Bleak House for almost 2 years. That is the interest of work by residents in this field, Mr. Speaker. The partnership with ETCL is a real success story, and I'm sure that the Honourable Member who shadows responsibility for employment will be happy to hear this. We have a very successful training programme for carers indeed, and our endeavours have resulted in 69 of our MPs, current employees, having commenced as ETCL trainees. Some of these are now in elderly residential services, not necessarily within social services. And I just wanted to, as an anecdote, comment on an example, because a couple of days ago I met with a member of staff who was one of the success stories of UTCL. He's a school leader who was the first entrant into the care agency through the UTCL program when we first started it in February 2012. He started with us training as UTCL. From that, he progressed to a contract with the care agency. And when I was talking to him the other day, he now told me that he's going to embark on a course to qualify as a nurse. So that shows us to speak that our strategy is good, that our strategy works, that people are happy, and people can now see career progression and aspire to that within the firm. So that makes me very happy indeed, Mr. Speaker. It's quite significant, Mr. Speaker, that yesterday, while Mr. Nega spoke of everything under the sun for the past 20 years, and he was extremely critical of equality issues, in particular disability policies, there was not a single mention or criticism of social force. This is very telling to me, because I see it as a rubber stamp by the opposition on how well we have done. The legacy that the GSD left in social services was painful. Although in my portfolio, it is certainly the worst department that I have come across. And that when I say that, I refer that to the government's then priorities and their lack of investment and support. And it is not a criticism in any way of the professionals or individuals who work for the organization. I am glad that with the hard work and sheer dedication of the team who work with me, we have managed to turn the service around. The development in the service means that we have moved on from a reactive phase to one that is able to strategically plan and also work in preventative measures. And our unprecedented investment in social services, and particularly in training, is an investment in the future of the social work profession, and in turn, an investment in the betterment of our community. Not enough recognition has been given to social work professionals in the past, Mr. Speaker, but I can honestly say that the team of professionals who work at social services today, whether social workers, care workers, management, or administrative support, make up an essential service in our society and should no longer continue to be unrecognized. They are a dedicated team of professionals who have my full support, and I thank them and the management of the care agency for the difficult work that they do, and work that we do well. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to the Department of Equality. As I have said in previous budget speeches, equality is at the heart of this government, and our commitment to equality shows a natural progression towards an inclusive society, and it is a recognition of a modern revolution. The government has been progressing the equality agenda over this term, and it's an advancement of civic and human rights. It was indeed a proud moment for me to have been appointed as the first Minister for Equality. And I was immensely proud that the first bill I moved in Parliament was the Civil Partnership Bill in 2014, the fulfillment of a manifesto commitment. It is legislation that enabled the formal recognition of relationships between couples of the same sex, a momentous occasion in the history of our Parliament, Mr. Speaker. And on the 28th of March this year, we celebrated the first anniversary of the commencement of that legislation. Introducing that legislation, Mr. Speaker, provides a further step on the road to a fair and inclusive society, and the right to be treated equally in the eyes of the law. As we heard the Chief Minister inform us, Mr. Speaker, there have already been 35 civil partnerships so far. We are a government that believes that the respect of a person's sexual orientation is a fundamental human right. Mr. Speaker, this is a far cry from the denial of gay rights demonstrated by the GSD. Why would Senator attempt to rewrite history in his speech yesterday? The reality is that the GSD tried everything under the sun that they could to deny the advancement of gay rights. Mr. Speaker, they even went as far as resisting an application to a joint government tenancy by a same-sex couple in what over the years has been known as the gay housing. It was resisted all the way to the Privy Council, Gibraltar's highest court of appeal, at a cost to the taxpayer in excess of £250,000. In so far as the court proceedings for a constitutional declaration on the age of consent, and not a judicial review, as Mr. Mather incorrectly referred to it yesterday, so concerned were the FCA on the issue that they even sent observers to participate in the case. Quite embarrassing, I must say, Mr. Speaker. But then, Mr. Speaker, though, Mr. Mather wrote a vision. The advances made by this government on human rights are greater than those made by this government. And while yesterday he tried his best to retract that statement, he clearly, the statement that he made in the Newsweek interview on BBC on Idaho Day, at least he qualified and conceded yesterday that we had, in so far, a fair right. Mr. Speaker, a guilty administration would never have seen the rainbow flag fly above number 6 on the face. This government, Mr. Speaker, has sent a clear message that gay people deserve recognition and respect, and provide a further step to a fair and inclusive society. I am proud to be part of this government that was bold enough to send this unequivocal message and mark a milestone in the legislative process. Mr. Speaker, the Department of Equality is able to coordinate and oversee matters relating to disability in all other government departments and is involved in all government projects. It is the policy of this government to ensure that all new projects going forward are fully accessible, and my department offers advice and guidance on this. For example, we were heavily involved in advising and assisting the Gibraltar Tourist Board at the time, and I wasn't necessarily responsible for it, on accessibility to beaches and tourism. We have seen our beaches transformed into accessible places, with improved walkways in the beaches all year round, including the refurbishment of the campus pool, which has an accessible ramp in built, has kind of contrasting with steps, which is filled with visual impairments. We've seen the dramatic change at the Eastern Beach in Brooklyn Bay, which are accessible, and we have the accessible units and mobility aids to assist people with disabilities integrate into our way of life in the sun. We also have the new Montague Building Pavilion, where as part of our policy on inclusion is fully accessible, of course, and has posts and the pools and easy access into the sea, and also has a fully accessible changing spaces, spa facilities, and an inclusive children's playhouse. This is a facility that can be enjoyed by all of the community. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, wearing my Minister for Tourism hat, as a result of these improvements, Enable Holidays, a tour operator specializing in holidays that meet the requirements of people with disabilities, as an accessible holiday destination, recognizes it as such. This is an achievement indeed for our initiative. Mr. Speaker, Access for All has been at the forefront of all our new establishment, and our buildings are completely accessible, and you can see that at number 6 Convent Place, the newly opened Gibraltar International Bank. We heard from the Minister for Health yesterday how changes have been made to St. Bernard Hospital to make that inclusive. We'll also, the new university will be accessible, as will the new schools at the old St. Bernard Hospital. The entrance wall is being refurbished to make it accessible, and Mr. Speaker, this Parliament will be accessible as well. In July, we will also see the first ever purpose-built facility for the Stay and Play programme opening its doors, thanks to Minister Linares, whose responsibility it is for. One of the most significant aspects of work that we have taken so far, significant as it stands for Mr. Speaker, because it's been a huge piece of work, is to review the current legislation and provide laws modelled on the UN Convention on the Rights of the Disabled. The draft legislation is now ready, and we are in the process of consulting all the relevant stakeholders. We'll be in a position to publish this in the coming weeks. The most fundamental change that the new legislation will bring is a statutory obligation to make premises accessible to people with disabilities. Consequently, the Department of Equality has been working very hard on a program of auditing and advising government departments on the reforms. These changes will also include public areas and not just buildings. The Government Technical Services Department, in consultation with the Ministry of Social Equality and the Geospatial Services Department, have been very busy identifying and making improvements in our community. Also, Mr. Speaker, they have all undergone training on accessibility audits, which were recognised by our department. Mr. Speaker, I accept that our manifesto stated that we would do this in our first year. And of course, in hindsight, this was a bit ambitious for us. But the principle continues to be just as important, and it's taken us a bit longer than we expected. Partly because we didn't envisage to solve the problems that we did, and also because it's been quite a complicated exercise, and it's more important that we get it right than we want it to. Furthermore, the principle is not just about the legislation itself. It's also about awareness, which is something that we have made immense progress on, and that is pivotal in order for the legislation to be embraced by our community. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, because the legislation is not an unconscious, does not mean that work on it has not been done. We all know that the voter's physical landscape has changed and is changing, and we have embarked on transforming it into a place which is becoming accessible, and we will continue with our schedule of work, Mr. Speaker. And I'm surprised that Mr. Medwell seems to not have seen all the things that we have done, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps he hasn't been integrated. In line with that, Mr. Speaker, is the disability action plan that we are formulating. Essentially, Mr. Speaker, it is a strategic approach to disability issues, which is what we now have through the Department of Equality. And while the plan is not yet published, many strategies have been developed and introduced already. It is obvious to all that a lot has been implemented, and it's a piece of work that has been thoroughly researched. We must not forget, Mr. Speaker, our legacy in that we are starting from scratch in these matters. This is the GSD never laid any foundation in this report. Mr. Speaker, we've come a long way in dealing with issues relating to disabilities, both in relation to learning disabilities and physical disabilities in this term of Parliament, and it's in fact unprecedented. The Honourable Member opposite, Mr. Nether, in his vicious diatribe of insights yesterday, demonstrated that he is either blinded by jealous rage on what we have achieved, when he achieved all of it, or is it? Or simply does not see what we have done, which everybody can see, even on Able Holidays with him. Does he not look around to see everything that's been achieved, Mr. Speaker, because everybody else can? He made a sign down for the Disability Action Plan, Mr. Speaker, yesterday. He had the opportunity to do it in 16 years when he had no responsibility, but he failed to do so. He has since 2007 to implement the UN Convention, Mr. Speaker, but didn't do so either. But he did nothing, Mr. Speaker. So I just do not understand his attitude yesterday. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, I will take no lessons from him in disability, in social services, or in anything else. Because I need to remind the Honourable Gentleman that this is not just about ticking boxes, and what we're doing is setting a responsible roadmap for the next 5 to 10 years, Mr. Speaker. Because honestly, Mr. Speaker, I fail to understand how Mr. Speaker has the audacity to pontificate as he did yesterday, when all these things were his area of responsibility, particularly in the last 4 years when he was in government. At least Mrs. Elil Hammond, when she was my father, prior to becoming a backbencher, could distance herself from the GSD failing, because she was not a minister at the time, but Mr. Nether was, and it is his responsibility for what he was doing. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, I'd rather concentrate on all the positive achievements that we have made in our term, because thankfully, Mr. Speaker, it's our responsibility, we are in government, they are not. So let's remind them that they are not, and they might wish to have a bit of self-reflection and look at their own failings. As my Honourable Senator Chief Minister announced, Mr. Speaker, support for our disabled has been has already been outstanding and has yet another increase to disability benefits, increase to the blind person's allowance, 50% increase to rates for consultation, significant increase to income tax allowances for our disabled, reduction in input due to them used by our disabled and elderly nephews. Mr. Speaker, I'm not suggesting that everything that needs to be done has been done. But a lot has been done so far, and this is clearly something that's a work in progress, and we are very proud of our achievements so far. We continue to work closely with related groups and societies, and that is one of the benefits of this government's open door policy, Mr. Speaker, that we invite, we consult, and we listen. Turning to gender equality, Mr. Speaker, and the Department also continues to develop policies and strategies in this regard. And while we consider the new census to update the information that we have, when I'm taking our analysis of gender issues in the workplace, we have to inform our work programs and initiatives to promote the gender equality and to promote gender equality and address inequality where it exists. We are particularly looking at educating and raising awareness with the youth. We are in discussions with the Department of Education to explore how to reach out to children of school age, and we are also working with the senior section of the Girl Guides, and we are working together on planning initiatives. We are also working closely with the GSA on initiatives and organized courses on empowering women through sport. It is a pleasure to be invited to the Girls Fund Football Development Programme during one of its weekly sessions, which aims to encourage girls' participation in football from an early age, with a message that football is just as much for girls as it is for boys. Family and education awareness, Mr. Speaker, I am delighted to announce that I have been in discussions with the Vice Chancellor Designate of the University of Gibraltar to explore collaboration with the Ministry for Equality to progress the issue of gender equality awareness with the university. And while we raise awareness throughout the year, I make a public statement on gender equality on International Women's Day in March. My message is clear, Mr. Speaker, that girls and women should be empowered to reach their full potential, but ultimately, people should be appointed for merit, not on gender, not to serve in equality. During my term, Mr. Speaker, I attended the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women at the UN headquarters in New York twice. The Commission is instrumental in promoting gender equality and empowerment of women, and the UN's focus is on priority areas that are fundamental to the equality of women and supports all aspects of the Commission's work. I also form part of the steering committee of Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. Through this forum, I hold regular meetings with like-minded colleagues and have been invited to speak at conferences of women parliamentarians that I have attended. And this is an excellent forum to learn and share best practice. In this capacity, Mr. Speaker, in February, I hosted the second British Islands and Mediterranean Region Commonwealth Women Parliamentarian Conference. And the conference explored the role of parliamentarians in ending violence against women and girls. High-level speakers, including the Attorney General of England and Wales, the Vice Honourable Parliament of Scotland, attended. The conference, and I am sure that Mrs. Elaine Hammond, who was also invited, will agree with a resounding success. Meeting fellow women parliamentarians was an invaluable opportunity to learn from best practice and take away some important insights on how we can most effectively work to eradicate violence against women and girls. Although strictly speaking a conference only for parliamentarians, local professionals were invited to the conference to speak as well as to learn from their experiences. Significantly, for the first time in Gibraltar, we have a strategic approach to domestic abuse, and this has been a huge task. In order to first understand the extent and the impact of the problem of domestic abuse in Gibraltar, we have been undertaking research and gathering statistical data. This has not been easy, and the exercise is not complete, because save for a few departments, statistics on the subject have never been collated, and we are now in the process of doing so. While we now have a better idea of the issue, it's not necessarily a completely accurate reflection, and we therefore look at different ways of collecting this information in the future. But for the first time, we have established a forum of all key government departments and agencies in relation to domestic abuse. And we need to discuss working practices in order to improve college coordination between relevant departments. The forum will meet at regular intervals and will also invite relevant stakeholders to work with us. The government recognizes the exemplary work undertaken by staff of women in need in helping victims of domestic abuse. In the past, they have very little support other than the premises and an annual grant, and we have invested a lot of time in working with them. They are actively supported by the Ministry of Social Quality, who offer guidance in addition to practical support. And where women in need have developed a professional working relationship with social services, and consequently, there is now much better communication and cooperation between them, and social services, as a result, are able to deal with cases in an improved manner. In November last year, together with the Director of Social Quality and the Head of Service from the Children and Families team at Social Services, we paid a familiarisation visit to the Welsh Assembly in Cardiff to see firsthand how the government in Wales was dealing with the issues of domestic abuse at a strategic level, and in particular, their policies and strategies in this area. There is no place for domestic abuse in Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, and my ministry, together with all the relevant departments and agencies, are working together to eliminate this in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, in respect of my housing portfolio, I would like to start by saying that in our first term in office, we have constructed almost 1,000 affordable homes offered on a co-ownership basis. And just last week, we have announced the construction of a further 1,700 homes. More detail on this in a moment, Mr. Speaker, but I just wanted to set the tone that this government under the helm of a Jacobin Liberal administration has done more for housing than the GST ever did in 16 years. This, of course, is not the only thing we've done to improve housing, but it is so fundamental that I needed to start on that note. The progress that we are making on housing is literally visible on all fronts, whether in the construction of new homes or the refurbishment of existing housing estates. Low-cost and affordable housing is one of our flagship manifesto commitments. The new estates at Monsalva Mills and Beachview Terraces will be ready very shortly. Indeed, we speak to the delight of many. This will provide 351 and 568 flats respectively. All the construction will, of course, have an effect on the housing waiting list, but we are well aware of the demand for home ownership, and we have not stopped at just the development of these of the three estates for long-term in office, which is why we have continued to work on the front for the construction of further 1,700 homes at the San Quentin Terraces and Godfrey Mills, so that we do not have a repetition of the housing crisis that was allowed to develop by the GST, who, by their own admission, did not make housing a priority. In terms of co-ownership flats, Mr. Speaker, the GST only ever built 804 flats during their long tenure. We had Waterford Terraces, Cumberland, Bayview, and Nelson, and we had a further 600 flats at Mid-Harbour Estate. So, unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, that has created the problems that we have inherited today. And going back to the construction of those flats by the GSD, Mr. Speaker, those who live in Nelson, Bayview, and Cumberland know all too well that they continue to suffer from the construction defects of those estates, and those defects this government has had to invest in rectifying. It is also important to mention, Mr. Speaker, that within the current construction project, there is purposely built accommodation for the elderly. In last year's budget speech by my friend, the Minister for Housing at the time, Minister Alain, we announced the construction of 12 of the same house and three master lodge flats. And only a year later, you can see how advanced the works are, and they are expected to be completed by the summer of 2016. That will give us a total of 141 new flats for the elderly. And will also result in 141 flats being returned to housing rental stock, having yet another effect on the whole religion. Much care has been taken not to repeat the mistakes made by the GSD, and we have consulted relevant professionals in the design of the flats, making them user-friendly and accessible, and avoid the inherent cost of rectifying the design defects of physical media and other systems. And let's not even mention the fiasco of the elderly flats at the old St. Bernard Hospital, which was so unfit for purpose, Mr. Speaker, that they were rejected by everybody they were offered to. Mr. Speaker, when we took office, there was a waiting list of 63 back to shower conversions in government rental service. This means that there were 63 elderly or disabled people who were struggling at home. And this, Mr. Speaker, was in the days when hardly anybody received 24 cents. This is the importance that the GSD gave to the safety and well-being of the elderly and the disabled at home. Because despite the waiting list and the oldest request for a conversion sought dating back to 2001, in 2011 they converted to 7 bathrooms. And in 2010, which produced this speaker, it was the grand total of 4 conversions. They said that of the year after, Mr. Speaker, because they did fine. So whereas in 3 years, the GSD undertook a total of 16 star conversions, I am proud to say, Mr. Speaker, that since we took office and made this a priority, we have in 3 years undertaken a total of 360 conversions. Well, everything matters, Mr. Speaker, whether it's a shower, whether it's domiciliary care, whether it's accessible places. Everything matters to the people who don't have it, Mr. Speaker, and we are a government who cares. We actually care about people, Mr. Speaker. And actually, after having to endure the swan song by Mr. Nether yesterday, let's remind ourselves who was the Minister for Housing at the time. Well, he was one of them. Yes, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Nether was the one who professed to be the saint or the savior of the people, of the disabled, the person who was preaching from the pulpit yesterday, Mr. Speaker. Oops, maybe he forgot that he didn't help them either. Another important commitment, Mr. Speaker, is the refurbishment of the government rental estate. And true to our word, in our first term in office, the transformation of the largest housing estate is evident for all to see. We have tackled the forgotten estate which was so neglected by the GSD in favour of luxury development. We now have made considerable. Well, Mr. Speaker, certainly the people who live in the forgotten estate seem to think so, even though those from the GSD who remain present in the town in the same way, Mr. Speaker, may not agree. Which is why they are referred to as the forgotten estate. Some people forgot them and some people didn't. We have now made considerable progress in the refurbishment project of 3 major government housing estates, namely Laguna, Glasses, and Mills Castle. Once completed, these refurbished estates will most definitely impact positively on the overall aesthetic appearance of the entry into the building. A far cry from the slum-like appearance that they were left to deteriorate for 16 years. From an ecological standpoint, careful consideration has been given to the use of energy-efficient designs and materials in a concerted effort to leave the lightest possible footprint on the environment. This has resulted in a marked improvement to the thermal and acoustic properties of the building. As such, a sustainable green design has been applied both as a process and as a goal. Mr. Speaker, I will proceed to outline in detail all the work that are being undertaken, Mr. Speaker, and I will go to this length of detail because it's important to remind people where we're at and how much progress has been made. In Laguna State, we are well advanced in phases 1 and 2 of the project and have now commenced phase 3. The electrical substation and accompanying civil engineering work also provides the electricity supply to the lift and telecommunication infrastructure. Phase 1 and 2 have been completed, and the work has commenced in Phase 3. And under Phase 1, Wadley House is practically complete and only requires the commissioning of the lift and the paving of the new stairs behind Wadley House. The other work is formed part of Phase 1, includes Bridgewater House, Mad House, Forbes House, Lamport House, Aurelian House, Bayside House, Maidstone House, Blackwood House, Corby House, and Nelson House. And I named them all individually, because we have not forgotten. Here, most of the external works, including the monopitch roof, are practically complete, and work on the lift installations are at an advanced stage. Works to Laguna House, Inundation House, Somerset Court, Liberty House, Kensington House, Jamaica House, Panamina House, Madeira House, and Bolt House, which are part two of the phase, have started and are progressing well. We have commenced Phase 3 and have at Resolution House, Forrester House, Somerville House, Devon House, and Kings House. And works to the extent of facade have commenced at the Mr. Speaker. All the above phases are scheduled to be completed by next year. Equally, progress at Glasses Estate is plainly evident. George Vega House is complete, and the installation of a new lift to its south elevation will be starting soon. The removal of the scaffolding at Referendum House is now complete. And I can only think of one word to describe the look of the new tower block, Mr. Speaker, and that is why. I said a word, work to the internal facade has started on all blocks in the estate. I said a word, not a moment. The monopitch roof at Constitution House is virtually complete, and those to Brother O'Brien House, Footwell House, Starbuck House, and Ironside House are well advanced. The refurbishment of this estate is scheduled for completion by December 2015. The refurbishment and infrastructure works at Moorish Castle Estate are very advanced, and consistent progress has been achieved in all blocks. Additionally, refurbishment works for Moorish Castle Married Quarters, which have historically suffered severe problems from water penetration, and other forgotten numbers of people, are programmed to start this summer. And the Moorish Castle Estate project is scheduled for completion by the end of this year as well as this season. In addition to the foregoing intensive refurbishment program, this government is also committed to continue the refurbishment work at the major estate. In fact, during this past year, refurbishment work has been completed to Kingsley House, Redstone House, and I can proudly announce, Mr. Speaker, that the refurbishment of Picton House will be undertaken during this financial year and is scheduled to start this summer. And work to Victoria House and Alameda House will follow. The general embellishment, road surfacing, and parking rationalization works of Alberg Estate, including the upgrade of the surface water drainage system and the replacement of existing access ramps with new disability ramps, Mr. Speaker, have started and is progressing well. Phases 1 and 2 have been completed. Works to Phase 3 have already started, and the remaining phases 4 and 5 will be completed by August. As part of the continuous maintenance program to Edinburgh Estate, consisting of minor external repairs, waterproofing, and roof tile repointing, we have managed to complete Thompson House, Donegal House, and Joseph Lagares House. And we are currently working on Alfred Duarte House, William Gomez House, Joseph Maguire House, and Manolo Mascarino House. We have Goro Asaguri House program to start in August 2015. Apart from the government manifesto commitments, other extensive refurbishment programs for government housing stock have been undertaken, namely the external refurbishment of Sandwich House and Anderson House. These refurbishment works included the external installation of the facade and waterproofing, the replacement of existing windows, and the construction of new monopitch roofs in order to eliminate the long-standing problem of water penetration. And I am pleased to inform the Parliament that these works have now been completed. Importantly, Mr. Speaker, We are now moving on to other estates, or should I say, other forgotten estates. And I am pleased to announce that the refurbishment of the new police barracks will commence very shortly indeed. The tender for this will be announced next week, and the refurbishment will include external refurbishment, construction of a new monolithic foot, and the installation of a lift. Mr. Speaker, there have been many changes at Housing generally, and not just to the change of a minister a few months ago. And at this juncture, I would like to credit the work undertaken up until the cabinet reshuffle by my colleague Minister Alain and the tremendous progress made under his leadership. And of course, before him, our good friend Charles Wilson, whose tenure was sadly called for today. The Housing Department has seen major changes in the last year. The technical and design division of the Housing Department was transferred to the Housing Works Agency with effect from April 2014 to consolidate the efficiency of how we maintain and repair our housing stock. A collective grievance created and subsequently unresolved by the previous administration that created an unsustainable fissure in communication between the agency and the critical Housing Department technical and design subsection has finally been overcome with this amalgamation. Brand new and modern office accommodation was designed and built by the Housing Works Agency to house the former technical and design division, and everyone is now under one roof within the Housing Works Agency centre. And at last, Mr. Speaker, the interlaced activities and procedures of two previously contending government organisations have merged to provide excellent association, interaction and accountability. The merger has enlarged and enhanced the scope of the Housing Works Agency's activities significantly. And whereas initially it was commissioned only to repair internal to undertake internal flat repairs, since the recent transfer of the Housing Department Design and Technical Division to the agency, it's responsible for all maintenance, upgrades and repairs, internal and external, to government housing stock, and also manage the major refurbishment of the housing estate. To compensate for the unsustainable exodus of operatives retiring under the early exit scheme negotiated by the previous administration, this government has engaged the services of the Volta General Construction Company Limited to contract out repairs to approved small construction companies. The fusion of all housing resources, Mr. Speaker, has created the synergies to bridge historic operational risks, to enhance the quality of services extended to government tenants, and it has translated into faster repairs and therefore a quicker turnover of housing allocations. This is evident if you consider the statistics, Mr. Speaker. In 2012, just after we took office, and following our initiative to refurbish empty and abandoned flats, Mr. Speaker, we refurbished 63 flats. The year before that, Mr. Speaker, the GSD had refurbished just over half that number, 58. But in 2010, only 12. The year before that, 2009, 15. Because, Mr. Speaker, the GSD would rather have flats low empty and dilapidated than allocate them to families in need. Between 2012 and 2014, we have repaired a total of 135 empty flats, Mr. Speaker. The GSD only repaired 60 families in the equivalent period from 2009 to 2015. The current self-repair scheme represents a vast improvement over the scheme in operation under the previous administration, which was unrestrained and prone to abuse. Tenants who are allocated a new flat can undertake their own refurbishment using materials provided and delivered on site by the Housing Works Agency, and now strict accountability policies have been introduced. This has been instrumental in a marked reduction in waiting time for the delivery of flats to new tenants, and has significant savings in labour costs for the government. The new scheme was introduced in September 2012 and has since extended this service to nearly 400 tenants who frequently express their satisfaction with the level and quality of service afforded via this government endeavour. We have noted an increase in applications for housing to speak of since the 9th of December, but this is mainly due to those expressing an interest in purchasing low-cost corona-fit flats in affordable flats, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Housing Allocations Committee meets on a monthly basis in order to discuss applicants who may need to be housed before others due to medical or social issues. The committee provides valued advice to the housing authority. However, it is not for the Housing Allocation Committee to allocate dwellings, Mr. Speaker, under the Housing Act, which was passed by the GSD, Mr. Speaker, in 2007. Much mischief has been caused by the opposition in relation to an answer that I provided this Parliament last week in respect of housing allocation, where they have tried to twist what I thought was a very clear answer into something that was not. Much political mischief and scaremongering, Mr. Speaker. I'm very telling that the press release issued by the GSD was not by an elected member. For this, I actually credit my elected shadow, because he, and any other opposition member who has been a minister for housing, will understand what I mean and therefore realizes that this is a wrong point. In fact, Mr. Speaker, the reality is that it was the GSD who made the changes to the way that allocations are made under the Housing Act. They introduced the change, Mr. Speaker, that is, houses used to be allocated by the Housing Allocation Committee, and they no longer do so since 2011. When the law was changed by the GSD, Mr. Speaker, allocations must be made by the authority, and the statutory authority in the legislation is the minister, Mr. Speaker. So much ado about nothing. At this case, Mr. Speaker, because if the GSD has forgotten, I will remind themselves of something that the then Chief Minister, now back then President of the Peter Kandiyama, said in answer to a question by the late Charles Wilson on allocations at the Mid-Harbour Estate. The answer, and I will read from Hansard, Mr. Speaker, is the allocation was done by the government, not the Housing Allocation Committee, albeit it was done by reference to the waiting list. Well, if they want to say that there were 490 letters issued, so Mr. Speaker, on one occasion, only one occasion in 2007, the GSD, the minister, or the chief minister at the time, said that 490 people had been offered accommodation directly by the minister. Well, this was done according to the act that they changed. With Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Backbencher has reminded us that those almost 400 people were directly offered, almost 500 people were directly offered a house at Mid-Harbour Estate by the government, not the Housing Allocation Committee, Mr. Speaker, just before the election. I'm very grateful to that, for that intervention, Mr. Speaker. In keeping with our established policy of holding regular meetings with tenant associations, senior officers of my ministry, and sometimes myself, continue to liaise closely to identify areas of collective concern and agree on restorative measures. All key players, as the Housing Ministry, as the Housing Department, Housing Works Agency, GCC, the Royal Court, and the Royal Deputy Police afford representation at an empowered executive level so that complex problems can be identified, discussed, and tackled quickly. The relationship Now born from these regular engagements go a long way to reveal the communal issues that truly confirm the tenets of each estate and foster a constructive spirit of partnership between housing officers and tenant representatives. The housing department and housing work services staff continue to support the tenants' associations on a day-to-day basis. Regular meetings are also held with Action for Housing where individual and general issues of concern are discussed. One final trend at housing, Mr. Speaker, is that the housing department is now based at New Harbour in order to enable the government to fulfil another manifesto commitment and put the City Hall to better use on its now in public art gallery. The offices have been purpose-built and are now more accommodating to the public, are accessible to people with disabilities in Senegal, and have also provided a better working environment for the staff as the offices are better suited for their needs. There is more privacy for clients and it's a more secure location for staff. And in the case of rent collection, we have maintained a presence in the heart of town and we have a counter available at the post office. As this department also moves through the time and joins the government, tenants are able to pay rent online. Efforts are made to encourage this method of payment and staff have engaged with the Citizens of ICO to promote this as a senior citizens computer fund day, which is super popular. Such is the improvement made in the Ministry for Housing, Mr. Speaker, whether the Housing Department or the Housing Works Agency, that this has even been recognised by the Ombudsman, who in this year's annual report has noted the marked reduction in housing completion. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I turn to my tourism responsibilities. Over the past 3 years, and indeed since I took over portfolio as Minister for Tourism in December 2014, the government has demonstrated a firm commitment to tourism, an area of the economy we immediately recognise as crucial for our sustainable prosperity, development and economic growth as an advanced, forward-looking community. Since we were elected, the sense of dynamism and energy that we have managed to instill into every aspect of our involvement, whether in promoting Gibraltar, the Gibraltar Tourist Predator Board, in our endeavour to open up new markets and fresh business opportunities in our dealings with stakeholders in the private sector, who have formed a successful and solid partnership with us in our domain, has been unprecedented. At the same time, Mr. Speaker, I wish to credit the sterling work undertaken by my friend and colleague, Minister Foster, who held this portfolio until the reshuffle. And during his tenure, Mr. Speaker, Minister Foster raised the standard of the organisation, making it focused and dynamic, and laid the foundation for the excellent results that we are now yielding. In the past 12 months, we have continued to pursue our objectives with the same clear focus, sparing no effort and investing the necessary financial, material and human resources to upgrade our unique product, refurbishing some of the tourist sites and attractions in order to ensure that we do justice to our growing reputation as a leading travel destination in the Mediterranean and one of the most exciting and interesting short break opportunities available on the holiday market. Last year, Mr. Speaker, my predecessor declared that notwithstanding the spectacular progress achieved since December 2011 in this area, the government plans to Gibraltar would strive to continue transforming the tremendous potential for growth in the local tourist industry into concrete proposals for the benefit of our entire community. In the course of my budget speech, Mr. Speaker, I will provide a detailed account of what we have achieved in the last 12 months. Gibraltar is well connected by sea, land and air, with regular flights to the main cities in Britain and now Morocco. The steady growth of the Gibraltar International Airport is critical to the success of our tourism strategy. The Gibraltar Tourist Board, in partnership with the Gibraltar International Airport and the Ministry for Tourism, have worked relentlessly in this sector. As part of the policy of expanding air connectivity to consolidate the rock position as a leading corporate destination in the Mediterranean, the Ministry has secured two new air routes in 2015. This makes a total of three new routes introduced during a term in office. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the expansion of the aviation services in Gibraltar has been noteworthy, and this summer we have added Bristol, Tanga and Casablanca to our list of destinations, bringing the total to 8. London Gatwick, Heathrow and Luton, Manchester and Birmingham being the others. The additional 5 weekly flights will increase the number of weekly departures from Gibraltar International Airport to 37. The new 5 weekly service to Tangier, operated by Morocco's national airline Royal Emirates, officially commenced on Sunday, 29th of March. This flight is estimated the shortest intercontinental flight in the world, Mr. Speaker, with Dakar and Casablanca, Morocco's main city, and importantly, economic hub. It is from there connections are available throughout Morocco and other destinations in Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and North America. This initiative forms part of a wider approach by government to promote Gibraltar as a tourism destination, as well as offer opportunities in financial services and commerce to Morocco. Gibraltar also welcomed a new UK destination on Sunday, the 19th of April, with EasyJet offering 3 times a week service to Bristol. And this has been heralded by EasyJet as the most popular of its new routes, Mr. Speaker. We are greatly encouraged by the steady increase in air passenger departures in UK scheduled flights since 2011. When just over 193,500 were registered, a figure which has gone up to 209,100 in 2014, notwithstanding a slight dip in 2013. In respect of air passenger arrivals and scheduled flights from the UK, Mr. Speaker, these have risen from 189,500 in 2011 to 204,600 in 2014. Both figures represent an increase of almost 8% since we took office. 30 passenger numbers at Gibraltar International Airport exceed 400,000 for the first time ever. We are confident that the new route to Bristol and Tanger Casablanca will have an impact on our air traffic and open up fresh opportunities for the tourist industry both in Morocco and the southwest of the UK. Another crucial aspect of our work in respect to the very tough and competitive aviation sector is the policy of continuing to engage with existing and new airlines in actively carrying out joint marketing campaigns to promote Gibraltar as a unique leisure and business destination, the latest being with EasyJet in the Bristol region and with Royal Emirates. These are often silent, understated tasks steadily conducted behind the scenes, which later produce the positive results that we all need. But we are not a complacent administration, Mr. Speaker, or one to let rest on our laurels, or, as Mr. Neville reminded us yesterday, to take the foot off the pedal. And the public can rest assured that we will leave no stone unturned in our efforts to achieve even greater results, in our relentless efforts to attract more and more visitors to our stores, to ensure sustained growth on all fronts. The Majesty's Government of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, is always mindful of seeking increases in air passenger capacity and existing services, in addition to exploring the possibility of opening up new links to regional destinations in the UK as well as other destinations in Europe. Not necessarily, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, to respond to that slide, I do not agree that this. Well, Mr. Speaker, in response to that remark, Mr. Speaker, that this is only as a result of having a new airport terminal, I do not agree, Mr. Speaker. It is a result of the hard work. Mr. Speaker, perhaps I could continue. Mr. Speaker, we are working on youth development out of Gibraltar International Airport with parties outside of Gibraltar who have shown an interest in partnering with us in the expansion of operations. This could have the consequent effect of boosting passenger numbers even further to the terminal in the long term. We want to continue building on our success of the past 3 years to put Gibraltar on the map as a major international destination for leisure and cultural tourism, to significantly increase overnight passengers in our hotel, overnight visitors in our hotels, promoting our air services, food industry, shopping experience, and our port as a cluster for professional shipping and maritime activity. This is an ironclad commitment. Gibraltar's hotel sector is going through exciting times, Mr. Speaker. Times of change, leisure, Mr. Speaker, and new opportunities. Total arrivals at hotels are up by 8.5% at 58,744, the highest figure since 2008. Other arrivals grew most as a reflection of continuing growth in the business sector arrivals, and it is encouraging to see arrivals planned for sporting and cultural visits. Tourist arrivals in 2014 were affected by the closure of the Queen's Hotel and the refurbishment of the Rock Hotel, and it is encouraging to see that room nights offered are up again to the highest point since 2008. Room nights stays grew to an all-time high. The average length of stay for tourist arrivals has increased from 3.46 in 2013 to 3.94 in 2014, the highest since 1994, Mr. Speaker. This is encouraging as it reflects our efforts to increase overnight tourism. Room occupancy and sleeper occupancy have fallen marginally, but this is linked to growth, and it is a fair point that supply has grown faster than the demand, but we are confident in this recovery. Again, guest nights offered are the highest since 1992. Guest nights sold are the highest since 2008, again with tourist arrivals growing faster than any other arrival, linked once again to the increase in the average length of stay. The average length of stay has remained consistent, but it is wonderful to note once again that in the case of tourist arrivals, it has increased. The impact of the Sanborn Hotel, the first locally established luxury floating five-star hotel, plus the much-welcomed major refurbishment project across some hotels such as the Rock Hotel and the Palace Hotel, has given new impetus to the trade, and we have seen these results translate into the statistics that I have just reviewed. Gibraltar now boasts a much-admired five-star hotel, the Sanborn, which has become an integral part of the Rock's social and leisure scene. The quality and sophistication on offer across the board, a broad range of services, is unprecedented for Gibraltar, and its presence in one of Gibraltar's primary nightlife locations, Hilton Village, has given renewed vibrancy to the area. Importantly, we have now developed an interesting and much needed variety in our local hotel bed stock to satisfy customers, whether they are seeking budget holiday type accommodation to the intermediate and the luxury crowd products. There are also proposals in the pipeline for new hotels, like the Marriott Holiday Inn Express, a major extension to the Palazzo Hotel, as well as a new British hotel in the Upper Town, which will increase the availability of quality hotel accommodation on the York. Mr. Speaker, our proactive marketing strategy over the past year has been successful in selling the Rock as the ideal short-term holiday destination on a global scale. And the improved tourist product has also had an effect on the growing number of cruise ship visitors to the Rock. And whereas in 2013 the total number reached 284,817, the figure for 2014 has risen to 298,512, and it is expected to exceed the 300,000 mark in 2015, with a total of 212 ships scheduled to call at Gibraltar, this being up by 32 calls over This is an area where it has to be said that the water tour board partnership with the private sector, with a dedicated local agent, whether it be shipping or store excursion, which form such a vital part of the industry, has produced the desired results. We have spared no effort to consistently promote Gibraltar as a leading food destination during our participation at the main international food industry gatherings and through our membership of the very proactive and influential Med Food Association. I am very pleased to confirm that Gibraltar will be hosting the Med Food General Assembly in the spring of 2017, and this will be the second time that this important event is held on the world. We have continued the successful policy introduced by my predecessor of securing one-to-one meetings with senior food industry executives in UK, Miami, and meetings of MedFood, and building up strong personal relationships with the top decision makers. Among the highlights on this front has been the agreement with the Royal Caribbean International for the visit to Gibraltar port of its newest megaship, Anthem of the Sea, the largest cruise ship ever to call upon us, no less than 7 times in 2015, bringing an excess of 30,000 passengers to the Rock and representing a significant boost to our tourism sector. This demonstrates the confidence by the industry in our role as a leading cruise port in the Mediterranean, Mr. Speaker, and sends a strong signal that Gibraltar is a serious and committed player in the industry, able to efficiently handle some of the largest vessels in the world. Furthermore, government is actively considering a number of options to increase the burden capabilities of the port to handle more large ships simultaneously. Our energetic policy to support the food industry and give the port a further competitive edge has further been enhanced with the introduction of amendments to the port rules for a series of general adjustments, Mr. Speaker. This initiative will incentivize Royal Caribbean vessels from continuing to call beyond 2015 and seek to attract more calls for other cruise companies. It's also worth noting, Mr. Speaker, how Carnival UK, a part of CMA Cruises and Cunard, has declared that Gibraltar is the third most visited port for them to call in 2015 after its home base of Southampton and Lisbon. Such is the success of our strategy. One of the aims that we have continued to pursue is the issue of cruise turnaround, which will make a huge boost to our cruise trade in every sense. We are working hard for this to materialize, and we continue to encourage several cruise companies to consider this activity, as this would provide incredible economic opportunity for the data. In the past 3 years, Mr. Speaker, the Water Tour Report has made a capital investment of $3 million in New York's major tourist attraction, as in Michael's case, the jewel in the crown of the local product. It's been extensively refurbished and modernized, creating a more contemporary look inside. Significantly, Mr. Speaker, the entrance is completely redesigned and has the installation of a wheelchair lift to improve access. I'm sure Mr. Neville will be happy to hear. And a light type, and the stairs have been fitted with lights with a new spectacular 30-minute comic that runs all day and enhances the dramatic geological features and striking views in the caverns of the interior. The 100-ton gun site has also been refurbished, and there has been beautification of the external area, and now also has an accessibility ramp which extends the view of the gun to people with disabilities. I am sure Mr. Neville is making note of this event. In the past, they only had access to the exhibition. New mannequins in historical costume have been located at all the gun enclosures at the Great Sea Tunnel, known as the gallery, adding a realistic view to the site. The figures complement the information panels and props that were also put in place. The World War II tunnels have also benefited from the refurbishment program and the construction of new accessible toilets for people with disabilities, and improved facilities for staff has also been provided. The viewing platform at Peel Gate has also been established. In addition, there are also significant improvements to the nature reserve, which are being spearheaded by my colleague, the Minister for the Environment, and will greatly enhance the Upper Rock as a tourist product, not least with a spectacular suspension bridge at the newly refurbished Royal Anglian Ring. I have detailed these improvements, Mr. Speaker, as an investment in our tourist product because I am delighted to report that they have had a noticeable positive impact in the number of tourists visiting the Upper Rock. Whereas in 2013, just over 732,000 were recorded, in 2014, the number of visitors rose to just over 791,000. 2015 has seen a consistent increase in the number of visitors to the Upper Rock, and at the end of April this year, visitor numbers were up by 9.2% over last year. Our unprecedented investment in the tourist product will ensure that we continue to have first-class tourist attraction that people can enjoy, whether residents or visitors or indeed people with disabilities. We want tourists to receive a good impression of what we have to offer and enjoy our products to the full. This government has shown its full commitment to tourism like never before. As all the improvements and refurbishments that we have carried out at the visitors and tourist attractions, Mr. Speaker, foremost in our minds has been the need to ensure the accessibility features and that these are included at design stage. And this, Mr. Speaker, has been a trademark of our ministerial responsibility. Of course, this unprecedented investment has been a resounding success with our visitors and all the improvements that we have made. Moving on, Mr. Speaker, the Rock has been an ideal location for weddings, and as part of our new marketing strategy to include the weddings market in Deepwater, and this has been reinvigorated. Two legislative initiatives last year, the amendment to the Marriage Act, which now allows marriage ceremonies to be conducted aboard locally registered passenger ships under special license, and the introduction of the Civil Partnership Act, which permits the same sex civil partnership, has seen more couples tend to be coming to Gibraltar to tie the knot. The changes create new business opportunities closely linked to Gibraltar's tourist hospitality industry and shipping registration. Since the introduction of the civil partnership legislation, it's now possible to develop new ideas and products aimed specifically at the LGBT market, and we have noted that a number of tourists have already taken up this opportunity in the last year. The initiative has opened up new business opportunities with what is widely considered a very profitable segment of the tourist market. We are keen to broaden our horizons in this respect by participating in new business opportunities, and this year the Tourist Board has attended two well-known international events and trade fairs aimed at the LGBT market. The G2B has also carried out a promotion campaign with a leading LGBT publication advertising the fact that same-sex couples can come to Gibraltar to enter a civil partnership as part of a tailor-made tourist package. Event-led tourism has been an innovative concept expanded by government to repackage everything that Gibraltar has to offer in new and novel ways that are proven both extremely popular with the public, whether resident or visitors, and at the same time affording the tourist industry a magnificent business platform to showcase the many attractions, leisure products and facilities of our unique destination. The clear rationale, Mr. Speaker, is simple. Organize a first-class cultural event with an international dimension that will appeal to the general public across the board, and by doing so, be assured that you will be attracting visitors to Gibraltar as well, on the strength of those events. We have found that many visitors who will find the experience engaging enough to want to start booking a return to the Rock as soon as they arrive home. We have worked closely with the Ministry for Culture and Joint Initiatives to encourage events-led tourism to Gibraltar. and the idea has worked exceedingly well. Gibraltar has been a glittering constellation of recording artists and chart-topping performers to send in our community to the appreciation of fellow jubilant crowds at the Gibraltar Music Festival, celebrations of local cuisine at Glen Viva, an international chef festival, the Trailblaze Open Chef Festival, the International Jazz Festival, and of course the Jibanko Gibraltar International Literary Festival, the third edition we are already organising for November 2015. And which I am pleased to say is going from strength to strength. All these tremendously successful events, Mr. Speaker, have served to promote Gibraltar as an attractive tourist destination. I have no doubt that the Literary Festival will continue to develop in its success for many years to come. Mr. Speaker, the United Kingdom Gibraltar Tourism Association, UKTCA, and Gibraltar House in London continue to perform sterling work to coordinate all our tourism partners and stakeholders in the primary task of selling and promoting Gibraltar as a tourist destination. I'm delighted to report that Scottish tour operator Osprey Holidays has this year become the newest addition to the expanding pool of UK tour operators to feature Gibraltar. The company specialises in quality, tailor-made corporate tours of 50 exciting locations around Europe. We are excited that Osprey Holidays have decided to team up with the Gibraltar Tourist Board and work together to promote this rock as a tourist destination. The Tourist Board actively encourages the expansion of the overnight leisure market from our core market in the UK, and it is particularly encouraging to see the expansion in the Scottish market. Once again, this government has shown its drive and dedication to delivering more visitors to the world. The tourist industry is part of a key part of our economy, and we keep working hard to expand our products in the new market. Our concerted approach to joint marketing campaigns and the G2B's direct marketing activities in the UK and in other markets have been yielding results in our overnight tourism sector and has been shown by the statistics, Mr. Speaker. Because we have seen that this approach has already yielded results, and it is precisely this sector where more growth is encouraged as overnight visitors contribute closely to the economy and deliver an always welcome revenue stream to those industries. Mr. Speaker, my main priority as Minister for Tourism will be to ensure that Gibraltar continues to build on its deserved reputation as a unique tourist destination which offers first-class services, value for money, and a whole series of exciting tourist attractions and beautiful sites. It is also important that we keep on working to ensure growth in our cruise industry and expanding air connectivity still further to other European destinations, in strengthening links with local tourist industry stakeholders and partners both in Gibraltar and in the UK for the benefit of all. Our economic structure reflects the proven resilience acquired over many years and countless challenges, and tourism is a vital component of the economy in our long-term sustainable prosperity. My aim, Mr. Speaker, is to increase the number of tourists who decide to spend their time with us, whether from UK or other European destinations or Morocco, that we continue to invest wisely, as we have done in the past 3 years, to improve and repackage our tourist products in a manner that allows Gibraltar to remain ahead of the curve and to economically benefit from all our tourist assets. We will strengthen our efforts in strategic planning and marketing to achieve effective return on investment. The brilliant figures show the strength of the tourism industry right now, Mr. Speaker. The great news is that the year ahead is expected to be even better with growth continuing. Our new tourism strategy is working, and it has brought a record number of visitors to our list. In conclusion, Mr. Speaker, while we continue to attract investment and develop tourism as an essential driver of our economy, our duty is to spend the revenue that we generate responsibly, and prioritize in delivering to those who need it most, whether it is through housing, social services, or any department that helps the public. The Chief Minister's address in London is evidence of exactly this, Mr. Speaker. We have spent 3.5 years working as a team of ministers who are great friends. Hard working, dynamic, and moreover, all of us work first and foremost with Gibraltar and its people at the heart of everything that we do, Mr. Speaker, in a way that Gibraltar stopped experiencing in the years prior to the summer. We are a strong, prosperous nation, Mr. Speaker. Our spending priorities are focused on those who need it. And true to our socialist values, we have delivered for our people, Mr. Speaker. In conclusion, a year of great success and a term which has achieved important developments for a fair and just society. As this first Parliament will draw to a close at the end of the year, I am very satisfied and immensely proud of all that has been achieved. And I would like to credit and thank all of those who have worked with me during this time.
Mr. Speaker, in the effusion of that reward for the brilliant budget speech from the set of a brilliant budget, I move that the House be now adjourned until 3 o'clock this afternoon. I think it's going to be a good afternoon.